I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is an El Paso native, writer and scholar Alicia Gaspar de Alba. She is a professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, and this is her latest book of fiction. It's called The Curse of the Gypsy, 10 Stories and a Novella. And we're going to talk about her writing process, how El Paso influenced her as a writer, and anything else that comes up. So stick around and listen to our conversation. Alicia Gaspar de Alba has published 3 novels, 2 collections of poetry, 1 short story collection, and this new book, The Curse of the Gypsy, 10 Stories and a Novella, along with a lot of scholarly work. In 2005, Desert Blood, The Juarez Murders won the Lambda Literary Foundation Award for Best Lesbian Novel and the Latino Book Award for the Best English Language Mystery. Sor Juana's Second Dream was awarded the Latino Literary Hall of Fame for the Best Historical Fiction in 2001. And she has received many other prizes, including the Premio Aztlan. Her fiction and poetry have been anthologized and translated into numerous languages, including Spanish, German, and Italian. Alicia Gaspar de Alba, welcome to Words on a Wire, and congratulations on this beautiful, new, and compelling collection of 10 stories and a novella.
Thank you so much for having me.
Or you could even say a deconstructed novel and a novella.
That's right.
Well, first, let's start, before we dip into the novel, let's talk a little bit about a few years ago, 2005, I believe it was, you came out with Desert Blood, The Juarez Murders. And I remember when it came out because it was at the height of the violence that was going on in Juarez, when it was considered the most dangerous city in the world. And there were a lot of books coming out, but yours really stuck out because, well, you wrote about it with authority, as if you really knew Juarez. And, well, you're from here, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I lived there for 27 years, and I always say that both El Paso and Juarez are my homeland, the border itself. You know, it's not really one side or the other. It's both.
Absolutely. When we refer to the cities here, that's, you know, El Paso, Juarez. That's how we talk about it. How do you think growing up here shaped you as an artist and as an intellectual?
Well, you know what's funny and ironic is that I remember for the longest time in my, even my childhood and certainly my adolescence, when people ask me, what do I want to be when I grow up? I would say, outside of El Paso. For some reason, I just really wanted to get out of El Paso. I had no idea why I wanted to get out of El Paso. And what's really ironic is that I got out of El Paso, but El Paso didn't get out of me. And I've been writing about El Paso and teaching about El Paso, Juarez, and the border, you know, all of my academic life. And my books themselves are, you know, very much rooted in that borderland. So for me, growing up there actually shaped my vision as a writer. And I think the ability that I have to straddle borders, very much following the lead of Gloria Anzaldúa, who argues in her book, her iconic book, right, is the Borderlands, La Nueva Mestiza, that that border dwellers are people who don't have to resolve their contradiction.
Oh, I like that, yeah.
Don't have to choose one side or the other, one set of cultural values or the other, that we live comfortably or uncomfortably with our contradictions. And that really, I think, speaks to not only my reality as somebody who, you know, dwells in the border, both figuratively and poetically, let's say, but I think of all the border writers that I know and whose work I use, we all seem to have that same ability to play with ambiguities without needing to define anything.
Well, that's beautifully stated. It makes me think of this idea that I think we tend, whether it's culturally or just easier, we tend to think on levels of duality.
Exactly.
And but when you live on the border, you realize that duality is kind of an illusion. That really is, there are more connections between one side and another.
Exactly. Yeah, that's fundamental to what I call border consciousness, right? That we understand that we are both sides, but at the same time, we're neither, and we're creating that in-between space that Nipantla space. And I know that you've talked about Nipantla on your show before with other writers.
Right. Yeah, Stephanie Griest, we had her on the show. And yeah, what's interesting about being from the border, I like what you said. You said, I left the border, but the border never left me.
Yeah.
And you've been in Los Angeles for how many years? I know you're a professor at UCLA. How many years have you been there?
I've been in L.A. since 1992. So at this point, I've actually been in L.A. longer than I was in it.
Wow, wow.
But I mean, I was in El Paso all the way through mid-1985.
Right.
And so I got my BA at UTEP, my MA at UTEP.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Wow,
in creative
awesome.
Writing.
Did you really?
Before there was such a thing as the, you know, bilingual MFA.
Right, right. Wow.
That I remember Professor Ricardo Sanchez.
At, no way.
At Miguel Aguilar, I mean,
really?
Wanting very, very much to implement while we were all there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're definitely in it now. And boy, I did not know that you really need to come and visit us and do a workshop for our graduate students. They would love you.
I would love that. Ben Sines and I are actually of that same cohort. So, you know, we were in the same writing classes together, and we were all going to the same bars in Juarez together.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Right. So you've been to the Kentucky Club, obviously.
Oh, my God. My second home.
Oh, that's great. Hey, so I wrote you a fan mail once when I was a graduate student.
Really?
Yeah. Your book had just come out. It's called Chicano Art Inside Outside the Master's House, which I read and just absorbed and thought it was so brilliant. And so I wrote you this really long letter saying how much I loved it. And I don't think you ever got it, though. Because
I don't think I ever got it. I would have definitely remembered that.
No,
I'd love to see it.
Because I knew you as a scholar first. But now, you know, you have come out with so many great books of poetry and novels. And you're translated into multiple languages. Your fiction is.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how you balance those two sides of you. Or are they two sides? Maybe that's part of the false duality. Maybe it's an illusion that there's a difference between being a scholar and being a creative writer. But how do you balance those two parts of you?
Okay, so that is a really good question, because I definitely made a commitment to my writing self when I got my PhD and my academic job at UCLA that I had to publish, you know, the creative writing equivalent of whatever I published academically.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and that was just a promise I made to myself.
Wow.
Because academia, as you know, is all-consuming. It consumes your time, your energy, it consumes your creative powers. Everything gets, like, remixed and channeled into, you know, handling the different stresses of academic life.
Mm-hmm.
So I made it a point when I got the job at UCLA to ask the dean that my creative writing be considered part of my, you know, productivity as a scholar, because a lot of it is based on research, and
right,
especially
absolutely.
Historical research, but also because my writing career preceded my academic career by 10 years. And the interesting thing is, and here is that sense of that duality, right, that I was talking about before, that academics think of me primarily as a fiction writer and a poet, whereas writers think of me primarily as an academic.
That is weird.
Which is a really interesting, you know, switch.
Yeah.
So people who've actually used, academics who've used my work understand that I'm
uh-huh.
both. But there is that very strong divide still between one and the other. And so, you know, for me, I've gotten to the point where what I write about and what I research is also what I teach in my classes.
Right, right. Absolutely.
What I write about in my academic work.
So you don't fragment yourself. And so if you're doing like the incredible amount of research I imagine you must have done to write this beautiful work of fiction, The Curse of the Gypsy, you could use that research in the class that you're teaching or in the paper that you're writing.
Exactly. It's the same research. It's the same process that I can also then teach students who are in my, I teach a bilingual writing class, creative writing class, focusing on, you know, a specific genre each time I teach it. I teach them how to use research and archival research, not only to provide context and, you know, texture to their work, to their writing, but also so that their writing can serve a social justice mission, which is very much what my plan for Desert Blood was. Right. You know, that it had to raise consciousness about the femicides in Juarez, that at the time that the book came out, you know, had already claimed the lives of a few hundred women, Mexicana, you know, women, primarily very poor, and a large percentage of them, you know, workers at the filadoras, right? And so I said, more people read mystery novels than read academic books. You know, and in order to really raise consciousness on this side of the border about what's going on in Juarez, I needed to use, you know, a form that would be a lot more accessible.
Right, right. But it's really important that you are bringing up these issues and that you are working towards change.
Exactly.
Well,
yep.
You know, one of my colleagues and also a frequent co-host on Words on a Wire is Tim Z. Hernandez, who just came out with a book called All They Will Call You, which took him years and years of research. And he used to talk about how he loved geeking out on the research. And as I was reading your book, The Curse of the Gypsy, I learned so much. And because there were a lot of terms, like the term payo, which is, I guess, how gypsies refer to non-gypsies.
Right.
And I would look these up, and it just led me to so many different... I geeked out. And I'm wondering, do you love the research part as much as you love the creative part?
I completely love it. It is exactly that quest. You know, it's like a quest for information, becomes a quest for knowledge, becomes a quest for wisdom, becomes, you know, this entire project where I can be all day sitting in front of my computer thinking that I'm going to work on a piece of writing. And I've spent the whole day, you know, geeking out and following the different links, which now with computer research, right, you can just link and hop from one thing to another. And at the end of the day, I'd be looking at what I wrote that day, and it was a bunch of notes, but nothing really on the fiction. But then that all stays inside you, and it all comes out later when, you know, the writing actually decides to flow. But, yeah, I call myself a closet historian. If there's anything I'm in the closet about, it's about being a historian. And that's why I love writing historical fiction.
Wow.
Precisely because of the amount of information that I did not get growing up and going to school on this side of the border, on the U.S. side of the border. There was so much information I did not get regarding Mexican culture and Mexican history that I had to educate myself. You know, on that.
What high school did you go to?
Speaking specifically about Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that was actually my first novel. We were referring to the Chicano art book, which was published in 1998. And then in 1999, I published Sor Juana Second Dream.
Right.
And kind of living up to my promise of, okay, if I publish an academic book one year, then the next year or two, I have to publish a novel or a book of poetry. And I didn't realize at the time that I was doing all the research for Sor Juana Second Dream that I actually could have gotten my PhD just on that work. You know,
I
didn't even think that that would count as an academic research-based project. Much later, I found out that indeed, you know, I could have finished the PhD a lot sooner. But, but no, I had to go and, you know, go the other route
and
you know, learn about Chicano art, which is another thing that I never learned about at UTEP or anywhere else.
Right, right. You know, you mentioned that book you wrote about Juana Inés de la Cruz, and I remember going to a Puente conference years ago in California, and you were there, and you read from that book, and you just blew everybody away. I think you read from, if my memory is correct, was where she was being interviewed by a bunch of men to see how knowledgeable she was, and she just put them to shame, and everybody just loved it, and they had a great time. But Juana Inés...
Yeah, that's an actual historical event that happened in her life.
Yeah, yeah.
The tournament, and I call it like her post-tenure review,
even
though she was only 19 years old.
Yeah, and Juana Inés de la Cruz, around that time, was becoming, and maybe this was a zeitgeist, I don't know, but she was becoming an incredibly important image of Chicana feminism. And I'm thinking you were there right from the beginning, allowing her image to become so significant to Chicanas. And do you...
Well, you know, I actually think that I continue to be the first person to openly write about Sor Juana as a lesbian.
Right, right, which was important.
Using Sor Juana's own work and not Octavio Paz's interpretation of her work.
Yeah.
But most people, you know, who study Sor Juana, they go to Octavio Paz's biography and it stops there. And they take, you know, the words of this self-proclaimed Mexican guru and, you know, he knows everything about Sor Juana. He even knows what she did not desire and what she did desire, because he writes about that.
Right.
You know, he's like, you know, to think that she knew what she desired at 19 years of age and joined a convent of bodies that she supposedly desired, you know, is to confuse her for some French heroine. Like, what are you talking about? She didn't know what she desired, but you do. So, you know, I take on authorities. Quote authorities, and I think that this is one of the reasons that the book did very well in Spanish. It was published in first in Spain, the translation by Grijalbo, and then it sold out. Then a new edition was published in Mexico, and it also sold out.
Wow!
What's really fascinating is that it was never reviewed.
Really?
It was never reviewed in Spain or in Mexico.
And ultimately, as you look back on it, was that a good thing?
Well, you know, I think that it's interesting because I don't know if you've seen the Netflix piece on Juana Inés.
Not yet, no. I haven't.
Okay, her lesbianism and her love for other women and all that is, you know, front and center in that show. My mom, you know, watched the show and she says, "Mija, te robaron."
They stole from you.
Yes.
That's great.
I noticed a lot of things in that show that are in your novel, and you need to find out, you know, how you take them to court because, you know, you need to sue them.
They didn't mention your name at all?
And I'm like, Mom, yeah, thank you for, you know, that show support, you know, but that would be a very hard thing for me to actually prove, but maybe not so hard. I mean, who knows? It happens.
Well, I know when I think of, you know, the cultural significance of Juana Inés de la Cruz, I think of your book, I think of your novel, and I think of how you help give back, I should say, her meaning to us, to our people, to especially to Chicana feminists is very important. And you were talking about Octavio Paz being the one that was the expert. That would be like having Octavio Paz being the expert on the Pachuco. It would be that ridiculous.
That's exactly my point. You know,
yeah.
What he says about the Pachuco is so insulting and so ill-informed, and that, you know, and he says it with the gravitas of an authority figure who lived here, and therefore he knows.
Right, he must know, right?
Exactly.
I'm talking to Alicia Gaspar del Alba, and we're talking about her new book, which is called The Curse of the Gypsies, 10 Stories and a Novella. You said something earlier about your research. You say you do all these research, and then you said something I think is just incredibly important. You says it stays in you and it all comes out later. And this book, The Curse of the Gypsy, is clearly very well researched. Can you talk about the process? Because as I'm reading these stories, and even though I'm getting a lot of this information and there's a lot of, you know, things that I didn't know, I never felt once that I was reading research. I felt like I was reading somebody's story. How did you pull that off and not let the research tilt it too much?
Yes, that's always a concern, especially with historical research. I use research to get a taste for the time period and a taste for the kinds of things that the characters might have seen, might have lived through, you know, whatever they might be looking at, like when they look out the window or when, you know, they're sitting down to have dinner. Mm-hmm. Because these details in fiction of contemporary life are very commonplace. You know, we understand character by what they do and the kinds of challenges that they face. And in order for me to know what those would be, I have to find out what that time period was about.
Right.
And I have to find out what that culture was about. And then not really having a book next to me while I'm writing, it's more that process of sort of, you know, absorbing all of this information.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I'm sitting down to write that scene where the character is going to take a bath or, you know, whatever kind of normal things that characters do that allow us to make them three-dimensional, I'm able to not make, you know, a huge historical faux pas and things
right.
that don't have anything to do with anything.
Right.
I mean, as it is, sort of want a second dream because it wasn't really very carefully reviewed in terms of the historical research, has a few details that a random reader wrote me about and would point out, okay, this is not, this kind of tree could not have existed in 17th century Mexico.
Oh my God.
But it is original to Australia. And it's all over the book, you know? And I'm like, okay, that is really awful that I didn't do more research on the eucalyptus tree, just assuming that the eucalyptus tree was part of, you know, the Mexican flora and fauna. And so I asked the press, when they came out with a paperback edition, to please change at least that part, you know, and that I would be willing to pay for the
changes. Oh, my God, no way.
Because I had to have the tree right.
Right, right. And you care that much. And, yeah, sometimes editors say if you make any changes that's going to affect the lines, then it's going to cost you. But darn it, let's pay if we have to.
Yeah, let's pay, because it's more important to be historically accurate. The minute a reader finds that inaccuracy, they question the rest of the
book. Right, right, absolutely. And that's doubly
They're
important.
They're not thinking about the character anymore.
That's doubly important when it's historical fiction, like what you write in this book.
Yeah.
You know, this, what you're saying reminds me of, I was at a party at Ben Sines' house one time years ago, and Ricardo Sanchez was there, and he read a story of mine in a magazine. He said, I like the story. He says, but you know, cause it took place in Mexico City. He says, but you know, the angel is not on Insurgentes. And I go, oh, but anyway, Granada. Let's talk a little bit about Granada, because that first story about Margarita is a beautiful story about a 16-year-old young woman whose husband went off to war, and presumably he's not coming back, and she falls in love with the poet Federico Garcia Lorca. I can't say the whole plot, but it's a really beautifully written story. I love that quote from Lorca that you bring up. I thought she was a... how does it go? I remember in the original play, Yerma was a, I thought she was a mozo, but she ends up being, what's the language that you use where he says, I thought she was a maiden, but she turned out to be married or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that comes from one of his poems.
Oh, that wasn't from Yerma?
You know, Yerma included that.
Okay.
But,
okay.
But the poem itself, you know, was about, you know, this, I don't know if it's, I can't quote directly because it's not on the tip of my tongue, but it's very much a poem about somebody's mate.
Yes, yes, yes. And that's what I was trying to do, quote it, and even though I didn't have it at the tip of my tongue either. But there's this wonderful scene where Lorca and Margarita go behind the Alhambra where they're flirting. And I thought, wow, how beautiful, because, you know, we think of Granada, we think of the Alhambra. And so I'm wondering, did you spend time in Granada, and did that help inspire you to deepen this story?
I did. I went to the very first Chicano Literature Conference hosted by a Spanish institution. And this conference started in 1998.
Uh-huh.
And interestingly, they continue.
Right. Yeah.
Every 2 years, they host a conference that's now including cultural studies, not only about literature, and they move it around to different institutions in Spain. And so that's basically how I've gotten to know Spain.
Wow, that's
to
great.
This conference every 2 years. But Emma Perez, who taught there at UTEP for many years.
Right, I remember her.
And I went to this conference in 1998. And we were, you know, just enamored of this place. And I was on a mission to find Lorca, you know. And so I wanted to go to the street that uh-huh. his family home was located on. I wanted to walk in the parks that
right.
he probably walked in. And I was just so filled with, you know, this notion of finding Lorca and writing about him. And this particular story is a combination of my Lorca, you know, research and love of Lorca's writing and the experience of being in Granada, but also an article that came out in the Juarez newspaper back in 1984, I think, about this old woman who has been found to have a petrified fetus in her womb.
Mm-hmm.
That petrified fetus is not something that I made up.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. Juarez, you know?
Right.
And so for years, I've had this image of a petrified fetus and wanting to do something with that image. It's just too powerful and rich of a metaphor to let it go. And so while I was writing the story, you know, it occurred to me that Margarita was, in fact, Doña Margarita of that article.
Oh, wow. It stays in you and it comes out later.
That question of why, you know, why is she in Juarez if she comes from Granada? She's a gypsy. How did she get here? What is that petrified fetus about? How did that happen? You know, I just kind of let it go. Let the character tell me the story.
Wow. And, you know, it's so full of rich detail. But one of the images I have to ask you about, because I'm wondering what might have inspired it when you, maybe it's when you were in Granada, but there's this image of Lorca going to a cemetery, and he's the only one in there, and he's sitting down and he's writing among the tombstones.
Yeah.
How did that image come about?
That's kind of something I do.
Right, yeah.
So I love cemeteries. Wow. I love going to a cemetery and sitting there and writing. And I would imagine that he loved going to cemeteries too and communing with the dead. And because in so many ways, he was such an outsider to his culture, his family, his time period, that maybe among the dead, he would feel like he was home.
Well, I tell you, Alicia, that's such a beautiful image, and so many images in this, so you can make paintings out of them. I could see, you know, something like that. But the other image that just really struck me, and I wish we had more time, but is the 9 female babies that were born in the second story.
Yeah,
and
the novella.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that must have been, that figure, the bearded female saint, is a true historical figure. But what was it about her image that wouldn't let you go and that you had to write about her?
Well, my wife, Alma Lopez, the artist, was working on a series of banner paintings where she was looking at female martyrs. And she asked a very important question. She says, what kind of woman would rather be tortured to death than marry a man?
You know? That's fantastic.
And because most of these martyrs, in fact, all were, quote, virgins.
Right?
They were saving their virginity for Christ. At least that's, you know, how the Catholic Church has interpreted them. But when you do research on their lives, you realize that some of these figures preceded Christianity or were right at the start of Christianity when it was the Christians themselves who were being persecuted, not doing the persecuting. And certainly by the second century, you know, we had that situation going on where it was still kind of a new religion. And depending on who was the emperor, you know, it was semi-tolerated or it was persecuted. And it was in that second century that this particular saint, the bearded saint, Saint Wilgefortis, who is also a saint in the pantheon of New Mexican saints as Santa Librada, also known as Santa Liberata, and then Encumber in Germany. And she's got a cult that is across the world, across, you know, different continents. And all of it, you know, have the same story about how she was going to be married off to a pagan king or senator or whatever it was, and she very much did not want to marry him because she was like a secret Christian, and she prayed that she would be made ugly so that her suitor would, you know, reject her, and the day that she was supposed to meet him, she grew a beard.
Wow.
And of course, yes, indeed, her suitor rejected her, but even worse was that her father, you know, had her tortured and crucified. And because, you know, he had shamed her and him, and she had shamed the family, and now they weren't going to get the benefit of this liaison with this other king or whatever, you know, his particular station was in life. And so I was doing a lot of that research as well as, you know, just looking at the way that Alma was painting these martyrs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, while Alma is rewriting these martyrs as queer saints or lesbian saints, I'm doing the research and then finding out that she was one of the 9 babies that were born to this, you know, lady, this Roman lady in the second century who was horrified by having given birth to all these babies and wanted the, you know, midwife to drown them.
Right, right.
And then the midwife then, of course, you know, not drowning them, and but manages to convince the mother to keep one, and that is Wilgefortis. So, I mean, the midwife is the narrator in the story, and who's also then later the nurse of the girl that stays at the palace, you know, and she just wouldn't shut up. She just she just kept telling me more and more stuff.
Oh, nice.
You know, for years. I mean, I started that during NaNoWriMo of 2009, I think it was.
Wow.
You know what NaNoWriMo is, right? The National Novel Writing Month.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
Happens every November,
right,
where people, randomly crazy people, commit to writing 1,666 words a day for 30 days to come up with a really badly written 50,000-word first draft of a novel.
Yeah, yeah.
I've been doing that, you know, for
That's
years.
Good.
And so whatever I start, you know, I hardly ever have a chance to finish because, of course, academic life intervenes. But
right.
what I end up with is a good beginning to a story. And
right.
when it came time to put together this book, I knew that I wanted very much to add this story to the book. And then when I opened the floodgates to the midwife, then she really took off with the story. And I realized this is not a short story anymore. This is definitely a novella.
And the title of the book is The Curse of the Gypsy, 10 Stories in a Novella by Alicia Gaspar del Alba. I wish we had more time. It's a beautiful book. And thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much, Daniel. I enjoyed our conversation.
I would like to thank my guest, Alicia Gaspar de Alba, for joining me on Words on a Wire. Make sure you check out her webpage. It is her full name, aliciagaspardealba.net. And definitely check out her new book, The Curse of the Gypsy. I'd like to thank our wonderful producer, Stefania Castro. I'm Daniel Chacon. And read a book this week, or read two.